here today with Jordy Harold, who is the founder of the iconic Iron Horse Music Hall in Northampton. And we're going to talk about Iron Horse and music in Northampton. This will be the next in our ongoing series of podcasts for the Northampton Community Music Center. So, Jordy, take us back to 1979 before everything got started, and let me know what you were doing and what you were thinking about as you moved up to opening the Iron Horse.
Jumping right in, it kind of goes, for me, it goes back a few years before 1979. It kind of goes to 1975 when I was a recent college graduate and I was traveling in Europe and writing in my journal and having big thoughts about what life might be. And I found myself at the Troubadour Coffee House in London via a Tom Paxton song where he sang about being lovelorn in London and playing at the Troubadour and hoping that she could hear his plaintive song. And I too was a little bit lovelorn in London, having been kicked out by the charming lady that I followed there, and sat there writing in my journal. And one of the things in the journal was the coffee house fantasy, because I was just taken with this place, the Troubadour, which had instruments hanging on the walls and was a cafe by day, but music at night, and already kind of had a storied place, you know, the kind of place where young Dylan had stopped through. And as I said, you know, Tom Paxton, who might not be a household name, but was definitely one of the songwriters of the 60s, you know. And that thought stayed with me. And when I returned to the States after my, you know, post-college sojourn, I went into teaching as I had intended, but it kind of stuck in the back of my mind. Willy-nilly, I became friends with John Riley, who, along with his wife, Patty Ferretti, owned the shop called the Madeline in Amherst. And I would just hang out and talk. And it gave me a little bit of that coffee house experience, because there were people who liked to talk about ideas and books and were just generally hail fellow, well-met and witty. And when I moved to Northampton shortly after that, and the friendship continued, and we started batting around the idea together. And I think sometime in the fall of 1978, we were together at the back room at Sheehan's, which Sheehan's was a bar on Pleasant Street, a wonderful, iconic Irish bar, you know, with a huge, ornate bar back with beveled mirrors and carved mahogany. But hanging out there in the back room at Sheehan's in those days, although the front bar was this very ornate Irish bar that still retained its men's and ladies' entrances, it did have a makeshift stage with some music in the literally in the front window, you know, where you might have put a retail display or something, and they made a tiny corner for musicians. And we went and listened to some music and had some beers, and we were hanging out in, as I said, the back room, which at that point was literally the opposite of the main room. It was vinyl tile floor and fluorescent lights, and literally, not figuratively, there were some used automobile bench seats as the seating. And they did not mean that in any kind of tongue-in-cheek or ironic way. That's just what they threw back there. And we looked at each other and we said, there has to be a better way. And we kind of shook at that moment on opening a place. And I said, there's only one caveat. And he said, what's that? And I said, we need to do it in the next 3 months, or, you know, the feeling may have passed. And I don't want this to be, remember 4 years ago when we talked about opening a place? Well, I've got the key now, you know. I said, let's just do it. And sure enough, we found the space on Center Street and had signed a lease well within those 90 days that I had set as an edict. And we were open 4 months later on February 24th, 1979. So
the space on Center Street, did it seem to have musical possibilities when you went into it? Like, did you notice that it had a particularly good sound or anything when you clapped your hands or?
I would have to honestly say, I'd like to give myself credit, but I wasn't thinking that far ahead. And we were also not thinking of a place that was going to be a concert location, you know, with in capital letters. We were thinking of a place where music might be part of lifestyle, you know, and in the original conception of the place, you know, as we imagined a place where musicians would be paid by tips, so there would be no, you know, pay threshold at the door, as they now say in the internet days, you know, that the music would be sort of, you know, part of the chatter of people hanging out, you know, although we quickly moved to a sort of a listening room type thing. But we thought that there'd be, you know, music, you know, three nights a week, maybe. And we envisioned, sort of country blues and bluegrass, as it were, you know, taking a tip from CBGB's on Saturday nights, and jazz on Friday nights, and classical chamber music on Thursday nights. And, you know, it was going to be candlelight and the murmur of voices and the attention shifting to the musicians when it was appropriate. And that was what we thought was going to happen. And we actually put up a sign in the window looking for people to play well before we opened. And well before we opened, we had a schedule of 7 days a week, you know, for 4 weeks a month of people who wanted to play for, you know, whatever the donations might be from the audience.
Could you talk a little bit about your system of donations? I think it was kind of unusual at the time.
Well, you know, it was a step up from musicians paying for tips. You know, there was kind of always that tradition of, you know, the piano player who knew every song, you know, whatever idiom it was. And we said, well, let's just take that up a step, you know, and make it that it's not just happenstance whether or not the musicians get paid. And so we actually circulated through the audience once during each set, very quietly proffering what was at first a jug that looked a little bit like a Boston bean jug, and then come around with that, you know, and put some, we discouraged coins, you know, we would kind of fan out a few dollar bills at the top of the vessel, you know, showing that that's what was, would be nice. And we also, within probably the first year or so, had table tents, little cards on the table that had kind of suggested donations.
I think very much from the beginning, you had a quotation printed on the wall of your motto, "Music alone shall live." Can you talk about that for a moment?
Well, it's the words to a German folk song. And, you know, like everything in my elliptical trains of thought, that takes me back to my childhood when my parents kept music in the house all the time. They kept recorded music in the house when they finally got their first stereo. And they also had live music in the house from the time that I was 4 years old until the time that I was 13 years old. My parents had what we would now, what was called, you know, a hootenanny, you know, people just getting together with all kinds of guitars, banjos, mandolins, you know, violins, flutes. And you know, they'd be Michael Rowe the Boat Ashoring away, you know, all night long. And I would get to, you know, come and listen to a little bit.
Did you play yourself?
Not with them. I started playing as that was winding down. And I think anyways, that was their adult only environment. But they kept it. They kept us, my mother hand lettered a sign that said "Music Alone Shall Live," blue India ink, and scotch taped it over the kitchen sink on the yellow wall. I can still see it, and it was completely spattered from the splashing of washing dishes. And obviously that made enough of an impression on me that got transferred to the wall at the Iron Horse. You know, my partnership with John was not very long. You know, we were in business together for something either side of 2 years. But he had a quote on the wall, which was attributed to a sage of coffee, which lightens the tongue, sharpens the wit, loosens the senses, and rarefies the soul. The lettering on the wall was actually done in a day when people hand lettered lettering on the wall. I liked that. They weren't vinyl cutouts.
In your first year or so, were most of your acts local?
It happened so quickly, Joe. Within, I think, about 6 or 7 months, we had our first national act. What had happened was, and this kind of circles back to a little bit of your past, you know, I was friends with. I don't know that I was ever a full card-carrying active member of the Pioneer Valley Folklore Society in the 70s when I was at Hampshire College, and there was the Five College Folk Festival, et cetera, et cetera. And my friends went on, you know, to reactivate what had been started by Taj Mahal and Buffy St. Marie in the 60s at UMass, and carried on, you know, first at Hampshire and then into Northampton, the Pioneer Valley Folklore Society. And I said, hey guys, you know, I'm opening this room and it's kind of modeled on the Troubadour. And, you know, we could probably gut out the basement like the Troubadour did and make a little music room downstairs. And then you guys would have a place to do stuff. And they were almost in. And then they were like, nah, we're a volunteer organization. And we just like doing our six concerts a year or whatever it was. And we'll find, you know, churches or, you know, meeting halls or granges, and that'll be fine for us. But in the process, the Folklore Society, you know, which with a long history and with notable alums, would get calls all the time. And one of those calls was from Mitch Greenhill at Folklore Productions, which was, I think Folklore Productions still probably exists, but it's a three generation now family agency, but that started out representing, you know, Taj and Bonnie Raitt. And they also represented Dave Van Ronk, and, you know, Dave Van Ronk, or, you know, Llewyn Davis, if you will, in movie terms, you know, was a pillar of 50s, 60s folk revival and reinterpretation. And the Folklore Society got called, and he, you know, Mitch had, you know, Dave Van Ronk, and they said, no, we're full, but you know what? Here's the number for this Iron Horse place. Just call Jordy, see what happens. And they called me. I was like, you know, washing dishes or something behind the bar. And it was that moment before I started the horse, I had been a junior high school and a high school teacher, at one point running an alternative high school program in town. But when I worked at the public junior high, I got to know some of the substitute teachers, and I said, how come you're here all the time? You know? And one guy said to me, well, because the first time they called me, I said, yes. So they always called me. And somehow that simple thing, you know, from, you know, another 20 something stuck in my head. And so when Mitch Greenhill called me and said $500, you know, and I'd never collected, you know, more than who knows what in tips for a musician, I was like, yes. and then we figured, I said, will he do two sets? Cause I, you know, did a his seat count. And he said, he'll do two sets for $500, you know? And I hung up the phone in a cold sweat, you know, and now we'd have to figure out what to do with this. But that led directly to, you know, booking stuff with Folklore. And then as soon as that happened, the word trickles out there without an internet, and the other agencies started calling. And at first we were like, well, you know, we kind of like this. People can just come in and hang out. We pay musicians tips. We, you know, we don't really want to have a paywall, you know, as I said earlier. So let's just do, you know, Sundays or Sundays and Mondays with this. And that actually worked very well for a number of years, because New York wanted, you know, Friday, and Boston wanted Saturday, but who the heck then wanted Sunday or Monday once you had the musicians up there, you know? And I said it in a more colorful language, which I won't put in the interview, but I said, you know, well, I'm a sucker for Mondays, so go ahead. And we ended up with a lot of people on Sundays and Mondays that way.
You eventually got a reputation for finding people before they became famous. And was there a way that you could tell when somebody approached you about playing there that, hey, maybe this person's going to be has some real potential?
Boy, it's such a hard thing to quantify, you know, to sort of like reverse engineer and put into words how that actually happened. And the real answer is that it's a cluster of things. You know, if I don't give myself credit, you know, I would say, well, you know, everybody plays somewhere eventually, you know, and by that logic, any of those places could claim to have been prescient or savants, you know, and know who the famous person was going to be, or they just happen to be the neighborhood bar or coffee house. And yeah, people play places, and that's that. So if I don't give myself credit, you know, sometimes I say, well, there's some of that. But when I do give myself credit, first of all, the word spread very quickly among musicians that this wasn't just a bar gig, that there was a very, very attentive audience, that it was the culture of Northampton and the culture that we established in the room, and that attracted people of a certain caliber. I was social. I actively engaged with the owners of Folk City, with the managers of the Idler and Passim and Harvard Square. I made my pilgrimage out to see Lena. I went to Ramblin' Conrad's, you know, down in Virginia. I went to the Main Point in Philly, and I just said, like, hey, you know, let's just keep the conversation open. Notably, you know, for like 20 years, you know, Phil Sagana at the Town Crier in New York and I would talk, and Mike Jaworek, who was at the Birchmere in D.C., who books now any number of other clubs well into his 60s, if not 70s, and one is one of the best bookers in the country. We just talked, you know, it was a community of people. It's like, what are you hearing? You know, do you get anything off of this person? Blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, we were getting, you know, in tons of not just tips, but unsolicited demo tapes, which I made a point of listening to, whether I listened to them for, you know, 10 seconds or for 20 minutes, kind of depended on the tape. But, you know, I do think that just personally, you know, I have an aesthetic and a sense of what's good and what's meaningful or what's challenging or what's interesting or what's different across a whole variety of genres. And, you know, and one of the things that was important to me and who we selected to play in that sense is that they were doing their music. And that cut out a whole lot of people right there. And then their music in their voice. And that cut out a whole lot of other people. And it's like, you know, every time you'd put on a tape and someone would start their approximation of Joni Mitchell's voice, it's like, next. But I got an unsolicited tape from Tracy Chapman. And at that point, you know, I was also working closely with Carol Young, who was my partner in my girlfriend at the time. And she had started a production company presenting what was then called women's music, or women identified music or whatever. And between the two of us, we were like, what is that voice? And there was a note on a yellow legal pad from Tracy. Here's my tape. You know, can we do this? And I was like, you know, when something stops you in your tracks, and it stops you in your tracks, you know, when you get a Sean Colvin tape, got the Sean Colvin tape. I got together with Folk City and the Idler, and we were like, okay, let's do this. You know, it was like a mini version of it, but whatever, you know. And she has sold bazillion records at this point, but at that point, she was a waitress at a Texas bar and grill in New York City, you know. So those things happen, and a lot of things happen, as I say in all of these interviews, or as I just said to you, by having a little bit of trust and saying yes, not being gullible. But, you know, when Avery Sharp came to me and said, yeah, I know I've been playing here, you know, myself or with my students from UMass, who's a jazz bass player, he is a wonderful jazz bass player, you know, but I'd like to like take it up a notch from this playing for tips thing. You know, do you think I could do a special project? I was like, Sunday night. He's like, okay. Or Monday night, whatever it was. So I said, well, so what do you got in mind? He says, I just want to bring in, you know, some other guys. And one of the other guys that he wanted to bring in was a 19-year-old Wynton Marsalis, who was still playing with Art Blakey at the time, you know, honing his chops. And I was like, okay, let's have it. That, I think, every time I interview and every time I see him, it's Stop and Shop. I was like, thank you. You didn't have to do that. That spun out to an amazing relationship that the club had with now the most celebrated jazz musician in the world over decades. A lot of it's instinct, yes, aesthetic. You know, I can't put my finger on it. Like, what made me say yes when I got a call from a very odd guy named Tom Bradshaw? You know, hi, Jordy, you don't know me. My name is Tom Bradshaw, and I would like you to bring in the piano player. Okay, you know, what's the deal? Well, you're gonna have to pay him some money. I was like, I'm not, never say no, but what's the deal? You know, and that was George Winston, you know, and it was like in Windham Hill pre-release. And prior to that, all George Winston had been, you know, not all, but was like an acolyte of John Fahey's, you know, playing kind of, you know, raggedy old barrel house piano and blues.
I know it's really hard to strike a balance between, you know, giving opportunities to local people and having the big names come in. And how did you deal with that? How did you think about that?
Well, certainly for the first handful of years that the club was open, you know, I'd say probably 4 or 5 years, there was no problem striking that balance at all, there was a fairly rich local music scene. So in that sense, you know, we had a rotation of bands that did interesting work or, you know, collaborated with each other or drew very well. And that was true as to whether or not that was bluegrass bands in the early area. I remember a band called Raintree, you know, they would fill up the room reliably and they would make hundreds of dollars in tips. You know, there was just that enthusiasm and that esprit de corps, that camaraderie in town. And then they were on, you know, on the jazz end of things. John, in his tenure there, had introduced Tony Vaca and Winds of Change, and there was the New England Jazz Quartet, and just were the real people with vigorous followings. You know, as years went on, even Jonathan Stevens, who now owns the Hungry Ghost Bakery, as a solo artist, you know, just had a big enough following from the hill towns that if he played once or twice a year, there would be a full room. And I think we just kind of like to use the word, we curated, you know, a selection of these folks. As we got into more than 3, 4, 5 years into the grand experiment, it became, you know, as you said, more challenging to create that balance because, well, now you have a room that's started out paying $375 a month in rent and is now paying thousands of dollars a month in rent and started off having, you know, two people behind the counter and two people waiting tables on the floor, you know, and a grand expense of $10 an hour to be open. And all of a sudden, you know, a busy night could be 17 people. See where that butts heads with having musicians in then who might not have more than, you know, 20 or 15 or 30 people in the room, and those people who might not really be there for a full night out and spending $10 or $20 or $30, you know, at the time would have been epic for us, you know, but they're there and they're having, you know, a 65 cent, you know, cup of tea. And then there's the math.
That brings me to a question. The Iron Horse really is three different businesses in one location. You have a performance venue, a restaurant, and a bar. Can you talk about what it was like to try and balance those things?
Well, for better or worse, I don't think I was a great business person. I mean, obviously, I had found my way, you know, in a kind of, well, how hard could this be to figure it out way, you know, when I was a kid. My dad had a little mantra when he was trying to figure something out that was outside of his skill set. I mean, he was a language teacher, but he was trying to do carpentry, and he would sing to himself, he figured it out with a pad and a pencil, he figured it out. And I just kind of approached the Iron Horse the same way. It's like, how much do you charge for coffee? Like, I don't know, let's figure this out, you know. In terms of the business model, when it first started, the music, it bore no responsibility for sustaining the expenses of having the business or even advertising the business. The music, all the proceeds at first, you know, went to the artist sometimes and then some. If something that we were selling tickets for didn't go all the way, well, that money was going to come from somewhere. And our accountants actually at one point said, well, this is what we're going to do. We're just going to call the music an advertising expense. So it really, there was no effort to directly draw money from that. Now, obviously, you know, it's all synergistic, you know, and those people coming in who we weren't drawing money from their donations, certainly, and we weren't drawing money from the ticket revenue on average over the year. So that led to, like, as you said, restaurant and bar, you know. And again, when we first started, we, even though the concept was a coffee house and alcohol wasn't really part of it, when the opportunity to get a beer and wine license surfaced before we opened, with the help of a small loan from my father's buddy, who was an editor at the New York Times and had always been very supportive of me, we were able to borrow money and acquire a beer and wine license. And that stood us in good stead. And when a liquor license became available, you know, some years later, he jumped on that just to have the complete surface. And that is obviously where the revenue stream, you know, was, where there was at least, you know, some markup and something that also attracted customers. You know, as far as integrating the restaurant with it, you know, I had watched places ahead, but, you know, like the bottom line in New York City, and they pretty much made a pretty aggressive point of, you know, a large salad or a cheeseburger or whatever off of people. And I was like, well, you know, all right, maybe this cafe food carries into the evening and it's not just, you know, chocolate cake and coffee. I don't know if that really answers your question. I know we had to, it was a very unique situation in which to work because, you know, you were a bartender who was not allowed to shake drinks during the quiet songs. You know, you were a dishwasher who was not allowed to unload the dishwasher during a quiet passage. You know, it's like, as Livingston Taylor, you know, once famously said, what I like about this place is you don't run the blender during the music, you know?
One of the things that I've noticed about live music is really hard to get, and particularly for I think this is true for trying to help local musicians. It's really hard to get people to come to a live show. How did you deal with that to try and get an audience for people?
Well, I think, first of all, we're in a whole different world right now. And candidly, it's a world that I'm not sure I 100% understand. Because for my entire, you know, tenure, whether as owner or programmer, you know, for those venues from the 70s through the early aughts, there was no question of, well, you could just live stream your artist from wherever they were, and that would be good enough for you for the moment. If you wanted to see the artist, you had to physically see the artist. So in terms of, you know, touring artists, clearly that was the issue. You know, in terms of getting an audience for a local, quote unquote, you know, local musician. And I, you know, I also want to say that obviously a lot of the Valley's local musicians turned out to be national figures, you know, over time. But there, I don't think there's any pat answer to developing into, you know, how we got an audience for that. I mean, we got an audience for that by being a place that people wanted to come. We got an audience for that by advertising. We got an audience for that by flyering. We got an audience for that, you know, with a synergistic relationship with the press, at least if it was maybe, you know, an album release or a CD release or whatever generation of technology we were in would be supportive of what was going on. You know, people like, you know, David Sokol and Tommy Shea and Kevin O'Hare. And frankly, not just in Northampton, but, you know, up and down the Valley, Owen McNally and other writers in Hartford. I remember Joyce's last name, but she was at the Brattleboro Reformer. And there were people at, you know, Steve Leon at Metroland in Albany would all write about what was happening in the Valley. And at times even, you know, write about promising locals. Uh-huh. And so all of those things, you know, went into the mix. But I from day one, felt very strongly that in a most perfect world, the artists just get to be the artist and make wonderful art, you know, whether it's paintings or photographs or sculpture or music, and that someone else would take care of moving that along. But the reality is that the artist at the early part needs to be part of the process, that they need to create a community around them, work to bring people in. We could give them flyers and we could give them quarter sheet handbills to help with that process. But to sit back and say, you know, well, I'm a UMass student and my friends think I'm pretty good, and so I'm just going to play there and people will show up. That certainly, you know, defies any conception of reality, that everybody has to participate in making that happen. If all those things would come together, but if I gave you this chance and you brought 20 people, well, that's not going to work. And you cost me $500 that night. You know, it doesn't look that way to you, but you cost me $500, you know?
Let me just follow that up, because, you know, club owners famously have a bad reputation among musicians. And I think it's kind of inevitable just because of the realities of business. But could you talk about that for a little bit?
I haven't given a lot of thought to why it's inevitable, but inevitable is not a bad word, but I mean, it's structural in a way, you know. It's like teens and teachers. It's like, you know, they're always feel, you know, oppressed by the expectation or the whatever the requirements are or the norms are. You're going to be, you know, batting against each other. It's like, you stand between me and what and the freedom that I want.
Let me just give you a chance before we go. Do you have any particularly interesting, crazy stories about things that happened that are some of your, maybe first of all, just a standout, memorable show that you thought was really exceptional, or and then maybe some crazy thing that a musician did or some crazy thing that a customer did? If you could tell a couple stories that come to mind.
Being put on the spot for 25 years worth of memories and 15 years after they happened is a little bit hard to, you know, to pull those out, and certainly into ones that, you know, fit nicely into sound bites. But, you know, I mean, certainly there were outstanding things that were, you know, huge compliments to the club, you know, when Beck took a notion to do some solo shows, you know, and decided that in the face of having sold 15 million albums, he was still going to play. He wanted to do a solo show at the Iron Horse. To be honored in that way and to have something, you know, so off the charts. But similarly, we had that kind of thing happen with David Byrne of Talking Heads, who came and played the club. And then in the sense of the people who we had ID'd early, you know, coming back and playing the club when Suzanne Vega or Sean Colvin were otherwise playing to 2,000 people, they would, you know, come back and play the club. And when Wynton was headlining every festival in Europe, he would come and rehearse the band at the club before he left for the tour. And those things are both a, you know, a sense of pride and a sense of wonder and a sense of gratitude about those. And then there were certainly crazy things that happened. You know, Chick Corea recently, you know, passed away, and his when he arrived with the full electric band at the Iron Horse, which first of all was nuts. You know, who had hoped that he would just play, you know, a piano duo, you know, with somebody there, and that would have been enough. But his monitor engineer decided that he was not going to mix the monitors from the house board position, that he needed to mix them from the side of the stage. And we said, well, that's fine. And he said, well, there's not enough room for my rig here at the side of the stage, so I don't think we can do this gig. And I was like, well, you've already loaded in and we've already sold out two shows. So what you're going to do? And he looked around the room and said, I have an idea. And there was an L-shaped wind block entry for the club by the front door that did not run all the way to the ceiling. And he took a couple of stage risers and a couple of big clamps, threw the stage risers up there, asked if we had a ladder, and put his monitor board, you know, halfway to the ceiling while he hovered over the audience as they came in, you know. So, you know, there were things like that. Because we were an out-of-the-way club, record companies at times came to see people at the club because they were like, well, yeah. We know that you're going to fill up your room in Boston and you've got your big following there, but what does it look like when you go someplace else? And, you know, what's the reaction when you go someplace else? And Treat or Right was one of those bands that when I first heard the demo that came through, I was like, oh yes, let's just do this. And so we did them once, and I was completely right. You know, the goosebumps were there. The audience coalesced, and they were going to come back, and they were like, well, you know, good news, you know, RCA is going to come and see us. I said, well, that's great. But they were like the opening act for somebody else, and they were late, and they were later, and they were late, and they were later. And so the audience had come in at 5:30 for a 7 o'clock show, and it was, you know, 7:30, it was 7:45, and they hadn't even showed up, and they were the opening act, they hadn't set up a sound check. And so finally, like an hour and a half late, they show up. And I was like, well, that's great, because normally I would have just blown off the opening act, but I know that RCA is here to hear you. So let's get with it. And the front man for the band, I'll obviously never forget, you know, said, no way, I have to eat first, man. I'm hypoglycemic and I am hungry. And that was it. He just like, they wouldn't even consider unloading the van until he had something to eat. So, you know, well, and then there's.
I'm sure there's millions of stories. Thank you so much for talking about this. It's been really interesting to hear what you have to say.